Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
You're listening to the Companion Gundog Podcast. I'm your host, Grayson Geyer, and today with me is Will Newell. Will and I have, I guess we've been kind of circling around each other for about a year now.
Yeah, close to it. I was trying to think when first contact. It would have been sometime in like maybe March or April.
Okay. And now I'm thinking,
the first time I reached out and spoke to you directly, that's true. Yeah, I've been following Grayson on social for a little over a year probably, and actually came and did the first St. Hubert's at Blue Horizon.
And I remember meeting Cheese. So and so for
most people do. They remember him, not me. That's kind of that works for me. I'm all right with that. I'm just Cheese's dad.
Cheese is Will's cocker, who came out and made a good showing at last year's St. Hubert's trial.
He had a better showing than me. it was funny. I was real nervous. Had never done a trial before. We were with John, who's a great judge. And we kind of, I think John could tell I was pretty nervous and got like started, you know, took Cheese off his lead. We're moving through the field and we kind of come to this little corner area and John was like, all right, you can relax now. And I was like, what do you mean? He was like, well, there were no birds back there. I just wanted to see like kind of how you guys walked, what you did. But yeah, now we're into, you know, we're going live. So be ready. So we get started. Cheese was like quartering at 15, 20 yards beautifully. He put a bird up straight away. I pulled up and did not take the safety off. And so like the most embarrassing part about that really is not missing the opportunity at the bird. It's the flinch.
Yeah. Oh yeah. The big flinch with the safety.
I think every one of us would tell you like, I don't flinch, man. I'm rock solid. Like I've been doing this for 20 years. I flinched. Like it was my second time ever holding a shotgun.
You know, that's an interesting.
And Cheese went on a big run. And like, it took me a while. It took me a minute or two to get him back. I was worried about the clock. And yeah, that was, second bird was much smoother. Everything was fine. Had to search for a little bit, but Cheese did a great job. John was impressed.
Cool.
So like, but man, that first one got up and I sure enough just jerked.
That's so funny. When I was a really young, kind of what you would call a boot Navy corpsman, in my first time like dealing with what we used to do, like cover the rifle ranges for safety or the safety guy and the medic. And first time I did that, I just remember striking up a conversation with a Marine, one of the Marine shooting instructors out there. And he was, and I, you know, being in the Navy, like we didn't do all the shooting and stuff the Marines did. So I kind of got there, like in boot camp, we're not really exposed to that stuff. I think we had to do this like simulated rifle range thing. General sailors, like it's just not the bag. And so I get there and it was really the first time I had been around much of the shooting part of being in the military. And this guy was kind of talking to me about pistol shooting. And he's like, you know, one of the biggest things to deal with is just that kind of anticipation of recoil.
Yeah.
And he had me hold my fist out, and he just, with a flat palm, started striking me in my fist. And I was keeping a straight arm. And he goes, just imagine you're holding your pistol out forward. And he did that like five or six times, and then the last one he kind of feigned it. And the ridiculous amount of flinch that I had from just that moment. It just goes to show you how much that is. But I mean, that happened, you know, whether you get a dud round or leave your safety on or do something like that, you know, it definitely worth something worth considering. Maybe some dry fire practice with a snap cap or something in your weapon.
Yeah,
it would be good for me. And I'm a terrible shot anyway. I just usually just let it ride. And whatever
if I have
happens,
to think about it, I'd get worse.
Yeah,
like I'm terrible in a clays range.
Oh, for sure.
Awful.
Oh, pin rate
so much better in the field. Because I don't have time to think about it.
Yeah, pin raised birds for me are like, it's so embarrassing because the easiest shots are the ones I always whiff on. If I'm drawing a bead on a bird, it's almost a guaranteed miss for me. If it's a completely instinctive shot,
yeah, you
know, I would say, yeah, I'm probably not that great at instinctive shooting, but I'm better at it than I am actually shooting the way you should. So right. it makes me look better to some degree, but yeah. And, you know, and I think too, in the St. Hubert's trial, and I found myself, I haven't ever run one. I was judging last year, so I'm really excited this year, but I was seeing a lot of folks and I was completely sympathizing with them because I knew I would be the same way. You know, because there's that element of being judged about your safety in the field and your firearm safety. They're so cautious about having their, you know, chamber visible or having their weapon on safe and at port arms, that it kind of caused a little bit of trickiness in their flush sequence to get in the shoulder.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, it makes you think about it. It's one of the, that was probably, I'd say that was one of the more natural aspects of it for me. That was like, you know, I bird hunted for the first time when I was like 13.
Sure.
I didn't start out like as a young kid. I wasn't exposed to it from like day one.
Yeah.
And that was probably, I remember those conversations more than anything, the gun safety.
Oh, for sure.
Like, this is a really cool new thing that we're going to try doing together. You know, my dad, like me and you, but the very second I feel like it's unsafe and you're handling that firearm in a manner that makes me or someone else around us uncomfortable, like it's over.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, had that, I got plenty of that from my grandfather as a kid and then guiding.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like when you
see all the bad behavior.
Yeah. If you're especially guiding pin raised birds, man, it's like, you see, there's a spectrum, and the dangerous people are on either end. You have the brand new person that's trying to be safe, but they're so, you know, they're walking around with their weapon shouldered or doing whatever.
Roll my eyes because I've got a story for this.
Yeah, and so you got that guy, and you're like, okay, man, here's the deal. I, you know, I'm trying to coach him through that and be safe, but anytime you're guiding, and I know anybody out there that's listening to this, I'm sure I've got some listeners that have nice gun dogs out there and are tasked with, you know, or choose to on their own go out and guide some preserve hunts on occasion. You know, that's a dangerous profession, right?
Scary.
Or dangerous, you know, even avocation to some degree. And so taking charge of your clients out there and coaching them through their gun safety, but also the skill in that is doing it without embarrassing them or making,
that's,
you know,
a fine line. I mean, if I do a preserve hunt these days, I have two places in mind that I know about where they will allow me to do it unguided.
Yes.
And they'll just put the birds in the field and leave me to it,
which
is something that, like, because the whole safety speech, it can, a lot of guys, it's not that I roll my eyes at, like, man, that's so unnecessary.
Sure.
But so many people go about it the wrong way.
Yeah.
And they make you feel like you have no idea what you're doing. And the only person who knows anything about this here is me. And you need, you know.
It's a really hard job because you have to take it seriously and you have to have a level of authority as the guide. And, you know, and so many times, like, you know, people that, there's a lot of young people getting into it.
Yeah.
Because the people that do it for a long time, you know, there's plenty of them that do it for quite a while and enjoy it and do well at it. But I think that's a high turnover kind of part-time gig for a lot of folks. You know, you do it a few times and you're like, it's not for me. I don't do it anymore. I don't guide preserve hunts for that reason anymore.
I had one recently in October. It was a little hot. You know, it's kind of one of those days that you like, don't, we said we would go. So we went and there was a guy who came kind of last minute that I didn't know, friend of a friend.
Yep.
And my first clue was he talked about he had got a new gun and then that, you know, in like a separate sentence about a minute later that it was his first time quail hunting.
Yeah.
And then about a minute after that, this guy pulls out a silver pigeon asks for help getting the correct choke tubes in. And
ooh.
All right, so this is a preserve quail. I'm like, I see, dude. He's like, what? I'm like, which ones say I see? Put that one in. That's what you want, because these aren't long. He was like, what about modified? I'm like, probably don't need that today.
Yeah.
we'd been out there for about 20 minutes. You know, we get the whole safety speech. I think we'd actually killed a bird at this point, and they weren't flying great.
Yes.
So we were kind of having to, you know, I'm already on edge, and there's a bird walking, and I have Cheese beside me. He's actually like waiting, paying attention, waiting for me to release him, you know, give him the back command and tell him to go flush that bird. And I said to the new guy behind me, like, hey, get ready. This bird's right here on the ground. And I turned back forward to watch the bird and kind of decide how I want to approach with Cheese. And out of my like back right peripheral, I see this silver pigeon come up to his shoulder.
Oh, yeah.
And he was about to shoot that bird on the ground.
Yeah.
And I was in between, me and my dog are in between him and the bird. I mean, he, you know, the shot string at that point is probably pretty skinny. And we were likely, the bird was far enough to my right that it was not going to be catastrophic. But like, you would have rung my ears. And also, what?
Yeah. Like, well, yeah, you just never.
That's one of those moments where you're like, stop. Everybody stop. Let's load the guns. We're going to have a conversation.
Yeah. And you have to. And that gets to, I mean, even if you're not in that guiding scenario, if you are the experienced person, you know, it's your responsibility to shepherd those people into this world. But also at the same time, we don't want to embarrass people.
Yeah.
We don't want to make them less likely to come out and try it again. We need people taking,
somebody did it for you, right? That's what I always think about.
Like, but at the same time, like, those new people have to come in with a degree of humility and be ready to receive some coaching. Because we're talking about shit that will kill you.
Absolutely.
You know, and especially when you're talking those distances with a shotgun, I don't think people understand that. You know, a cylinder bore at 20 feet is still, with birdshot, is still just putting a hole in a piece of plywood. That's killing
there's
you.
No spread there.
No, there's no spread, you know? And so if you're in those kind of distances with your hunting partners, and you tag them, that's game over.
Are you familiar with the name Earl Storm?
I'm not.
So he's an old guide down in Bladen County. He owned a place called Wintergreen Hunt and Preserve, the farm that my mom grew up on that, like, we still, you know, you've heard me talk about. That's kind of in lower Sampson County. So not far from Bladenboro, Clarkton, like that whole area. And like right on the other side of White Lake, for anybody who knows southeastern North Carolina that's out there listening. Earl Storm was like, he was the former sheriff of Bladen County. Just an old badass, just like kind of, you know, the type. He's an old bird hunt dude. Like, he doesn't take any crap off of anybody. And I mentioned the first time I went when I was 13. So the reason we got a shotgun is my dad worked for the bank. There was a Sport and Clay shoot coming up. So he was like, Bob, you got to get a shotgun. And so he goes out to, I think, Camel Pond in downtown Winston, picks up an 870 12 gauge, like 28 inch barrel. And that's what we went out on the quail hunt with for our first time. So like, hearing you talk, that's why I chuckled when you said dose of humility.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I was like, I got that right off the bat. Cause Earl Storm looked at us and kind of went, that's duck gun.
I know what I'm dealing with here.
What y'all boys doing out here? Y'all need that. That's too much gun.
Oh, yeah.
Just kind of, you know, was on us in a fun, like, kind of
letting you know,
nice
he
enough
knew.
Way, like, yeah. You know, and we don't, if you guys just kind of wait for me to tell you when to do what, we'll get through this.
You know that I know that you know
uh-huh.
that you're a novice.
He just went right up to that line of like talking just enough crap.
Yeah. And that's the skill, right? And then of course you got those guys that the authority comes natural to, the old sheriff or whatever. And he can speak from that place and not offend people because he just has so much experience in that way. But it's those new guys getting into guiding. And, you know, if you're out there listening and you're one of those, you know, you got your first UT1 dog and you're proud of it and you're starting to pick up some gigs guiding local preserves, you know, advocate for your dog, advocate for yourself and learn quickly how to, you know, a lot of times you're going to be out there with affluent guests and things like that. Learn quickly to take that position of authority. And, you know, at the end of the day, your safety, your dog's safety, and then all of the party out there with you, you know, that's in your hands and take that seriously and just know it's dangerous. And I had an experience this year on the dove field for the first time ever in my life.
Oh yeah.
I've coming up around Marines, anytime there's an accidental discharge, there's no such thing as an accidental discharge in the Marine Corps. They're all negligent discharges, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so I that always rings in my ears, but I was on the dove field with my buddy Abe. We were down in South Carolina, and it's like an early 30s model LC Smith 12 gauge, 28 inch barrels, choked, not mod, like mod, improve mod. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I'll take, that's a good dove gun for me. Right. Like, you know, and so, and I'd shot it, I'd actually taken it duck shooting a few times, and it was a, and so I still haven't found whether or not this is a common issue, but it's a single trigger. And I did look back that was like the less desirable. So it's this ideal grade, early 30, beautiful gun, beautiful walnut stock. And so I had taken it duck hunting a couple of times, and I had put some modern loads through it. And that is probably the culprit in this regard. But I'm out there with some lighter dove loads on this shoot, and had taken a couple of cracks, and I'm sitting there we were standing at the tree line in the shade. It was a hot day. Had Althea not completely at heel, but like 3 feet ahead of me, kind of watching the skies, and off to my left just a bit. Got the gun cracked over my right arm, load it, doves come in, it's broken. I go ahead to close it as I'm watching the doves come in. Had it on safe, and closed the weapon, and the damn thing discharged. And it discharged like 3 feet to the right into the ground of my dog.
Yeah, because you're trying to stay still, so you're not picking the gun up as you close.
You're trying to do it.
Luckily, yeah, you're trying to do it.
And so luckily, I want the bird
to close that last 15 yards.
Luckily, the muscle memory of, you know, some muzzle discipline and those things were because it was no thought process. And my first thought was I had my finger on the trigger and the safety off as I closed that gun. I thought that must have been it, but then I just ran it right back through in a safer area. And of course the thing discharged as I closed it. And so,
just like weakened the sear or whatever.
I have no idea. I haven't opened it up and I haven't taken it to anybody yet. It's just hanging right now. And with a trigger guard on it you know, one day I'll take it in, but now I don't trust the mechanism, you know? And so I don't know, even though if I take it and have it fixed, if I'll ever fire it.
I had one of those Remington 700s that got recalled.
Did you? Yeah. I have one of the,
how old was I? I would have been in college. So I was probably 20.
Yeah.
Sitting in a deer stand and had a doe out there. It was right around Christmas, went to close up.
Yep.
And as soon as I threw the bolt closed, it just bam.
Yeah. I mean, it's the scariest feeling in the world. Cause you're just sending,
you're not ready for it. It's
sending something down range that you're not prepared to. I mean, it's a bad feeling. So, you know, all of you guys, we're out here. I mean, we kind of kicked this thing off really quick. But it's all on topic and it's all on brand for what we're going to discuss today to some degree. But you know, this is an important subject, which is firearm safety, which I don't think gets enough love in like popular hunting shooting culture, you know, and especially in the bird dog podcast stuff. But you know, I remember as a kid, I've got an uncle that had a story he never talked about, but it was you know, he had a friend when they were kids quail hunting that died in a hunting accident, you know, something similar to that. And so, you know, it's remember that, guys, we're out here, we're handling these loaded guns and
you gotta be alert. I had a friend, his lab got shot 2 years ago on a hunt right outside of Fayetteville. It was like, you know, a big ringneck shoot. Like they had, you know, blinds all around this lake. There's a bunch of guys out there. It gets a little bit chaotic. There's birds dive bombing in, and his like 1 year old lab at that point was swimming back with a bird in the mouth.
Yep.
And somebody thought it was a cripple on the water, couldn't see the dog behind the bird in a low light situation.
Actually, just leveled off and shot it.
Leveled off and lit the dog up. Lost an eye, dog made it.
Oh, wow.
Lost an eye, but made it, yeah.
Holy smokes. Yeah, I mean, I think about that all the time, duck hunting. It's like, you know, when I'm out there with a bigger party, you know, I never fail to say, hey, you know, no shooting cripples in the decoys, you know, I'm sending my dog. But, I think that's one reason it's important to have a steady lab. You know, a lot of guys,
all big time,
and I know some like top end guides that are happy with their dog breaking on the shot.
It gets dangerous. You better trust.
Yeah, you better
everybody that you're with,
and you better feel like you got control of that part. You can say it, and they're gonna, you know, you can pull them back. And I mean, there's countless stories. I mean, if you know guides, if you've been living in this world for any period of time, I mean, especially the old crusty guys. When I go down east and duck hunt with them, every single one of them's got a story. About, you know, and one guy doesn't like break action guns in the blind because, you know, when you close that gun in the blind, it's you got to hang it over the edge. Yeah, exactly. Stuff like that. And there's always a reason for that. So, you know, I guess that's a great opportunity to segue into why we're here today. So Will, we didn't even really get to introduce you at all. We jumped right in on that one.
You guys, well, y'all, I mean, you know, you got a pretty good idea who I am. Now.
Yeah, well,
you
we've
heard me speak on some subjects.
Yeah, we've been on we've been on some podcast together. Yeah. Prior and
organization not to be named.
I'll keep that one out of my mouth. Will was, like I said, we met at last year's St. Hubert's trial, and this year Will is helping by taking a leadership role in the current trial. And so I just wanted to get together with you. Number one, we got to continue to promote the thing. We had a little hiccup early in our registration process. We lost the grounds we were going to use. And so we've kind of dropped back and we're going, luckily, I think got a better venue, got as good a venue as that exists on the East Coast, I think, in H. Cooper Black State Park and Field Trial Ground down in South Carolina. It's for those that have never been, it is a pristine place to hold a trial like this, you know, and it's
it looks beautiful.
It's amazing.
I'm excited there's camping, so it's actually a state park. I don't know if y'all caught that Grayson just said that. Yeah. So, like, that's, I know he was talking, I'm going to be down there Friday night and Saturday night, and, you know.
Yeah,
we're excited to actually spend some time. Hopefully share a campfire with some of the participants. And
that's,
you know.
Yep. That's my plan. My plan is to rent a camper this time around. I haven't pulled that together yet, but I'm going to try.
It's the off season. It should be pretty.
Yeah. You would available. Think you can find them relatively easily. So I want to rent a camper, but they have a lovely campground for RVs. And I'm sure you can find some tent camping on the, on site if you wanted to, but they've got hot showers, good facilities there. It's a fantastic place for that. And, you know, I mean, Hartsville's kind of close and Shiraz kind of close. And so you can get a hotel and it's not a, inconvenient drive in.
I imagine Hartsville with all the Sunoco presence probably has at least one nice hotel.
Oh, they've got, probably got a couple, yeah. Like, and it, nice even ones. There's kind of one of those hotels that you know is really nice in like 87.
Yeah.
But is now like kind of degraded into maybe not a Roach Motel, but I actually stay at that one all the time and I love it because it's got all the amenities.
Right.
They're just kind of stuck in 35 years ago, you know.
Sometimes that's a good thing.
Yeah.
We stayed at a place like that this past weekend with our girls. They took them to Pinehurst for the Christmas tree lighting down there.
Oh, cool.
I lived in Southern Pines as a kid, but we stayed at Pine Needles Lodge. It's kind of like this old, like, it's just stuck in time in the late 60s, and it's cool to visit like an old motor court kind of place like that. I mean, they don't make them like that anymore.
No,
like that
concept
is dead.
Yeah,
we're going to get off on another tangent.
I know.
I mean,
we can go down that road for a while. Because I lived in Southern Pines as a kid too.
But, oh, nice.
But you know, so I guess moving forward, you know, from a promotional standpoint, and for the sake of this trial, you know, this is another appeal, a call to action. You know, so if you hear this, and you have a dog that you think might enjoy a very basic style field trial where you're out hunting with your dog, and the I guess the objectives are conservation, ethics, safety, and fun.
Well, that's the cool thing about it. Like, at least I would say half of the criteria, without having the sheet in front of me, upon which an entrant, a team really, like a hunter dog team, is judged is, you don't have to be an experienced dog handler to be able to, like,
can you go have, well, can you have fun with your dog? Can,
exactly.
You know, I mean, I think for me, judging last year, that was the thing. Like, the guys that were having the most fun were the ones that were scoring the highest.
Yeah.
You could tell. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that they were comfortable with firearm safety and things like that to begin. One was a guy, actually both are guides.
Yeah.
So it was like, I guess that makes complete sense. Both of these dudes, Landon and oh gosh, I'm sorry if you're out there listening. I'm blanking on your name. Anybody that knows me knows that that's not, I've done that to lifelong friends in my life. So, but the, both of the guys that won first and second in the pointing dog division were guys.
And the dog was Ruby Thews.
Yeah. Ruby Thews.
What's
right?
The guy's name? He lives in like, person.
Yeah, he lives up there near Caswell.
Golly.
I'll think of it. And I am so sorry. I am so sorry, dude, because I really like admire this guy, enjoy it, and really liked running with him.
Scratching Dan Kennels.
Yep. Yeah.
I can think of everything but his damn name.
Why am I struggling? So I'm so sorry. I
went to App State. I remember that because I met him. He was a really nice guy. We had
just a super cool dude and a very memorable guy. I can remember everything in the world about him except his name.
Vishla?
Yeah, it's Ruby Thews. Uh-huh. But either way, like, just a fan.
Carhartt overalls. I remember it all.
Yeah, exactly. And I've spoken to him since. Trey Wright.
There it is.
Thanks. Hey, Trey, dude, please, for the love of God, forgive me about that, man. I
wish we had had a timer on that. That was a solid, 45 minutes of two guys with ADD, calling out context clues until somebody got there.
Yeah, Trey's an awesome guy with a super awesome dog and a very, you could tell, very experienced guy. And the same as Landon. And it just made... You know, those guys just have so much experience with the gun safety aspect, I think, that they're not thinking about it.
Right.
Right. And they're doing everything correctly. So there's no, you know, they're comfortable moving within the boundaries of what's safe and what's not. And so, again, it's just a thoughtless process for them. And so nobody else was getting dinged. But I think what it allows for is those guys are so well practiced at it. There's no fault. There's no missteps. They're not, you know, they're not leaving their safeties on. They're not, you know, and things that I would be guilty of. I'm just out.
I remember John telling me what saved me and got cheesing out of the pass because I missed that bird.
Yeah.
I'm very inexperienced. I have no idea what I'm doing. He said one was I picked up shells.
Yep.
Stopped and did that because that's just second nature. And the second thing was on that second bird when we, I think I clipped a wing and dropped a leg.
Yep.
So it was still kind of on the move. You know, it wasn't locked in place. And I looked for 10 minutes, which I knew it was in this spot. It had gotten buried in some thick stuff. And he's got to get in there to it, but kept calling him back to a spot. And finally we got the bird out of there. And John was like, man, a lot of people would have just said well, I thought it was here, but I don't know where it is. And
John, I love that guy, man, because he really, probably more than me that day, he took that so, the safety and the conservation ethic and all those things, he really let that play into the shoot. And just the fact that you did look for that cripple for so long should have been, should have weighed very heavily for you. And I'm not sure I judged it that way with that thought.
Well, it's a little bit different with pointers. I mean, there's not as much of a retrieve. Cause I remember that's if you look at the rules as you're checking out.
Yeah. The retrieve is worth a lot more
on
to
the
you
Facebook
guys.
Page. Yeah. In the flusher class, the retrieve is way heavier weighted than the pointer class.
And then at the end of the day too, though, it's that's, I mean, if there's any, if we think of dogs as tools for conservation, that's what they do.
Oh yeah.
Is they bring us the game. They find it, mm-hmm. And yeah, there's those type of things. When a bird gets buried up under a bunch of, Lespedeza and pushed over Johnson grass or broom sedge or whatever, you're not finding that thing.
Wood duck goes and crams up under a log in the swamp.
Exactly.
Being, 8 inches of water, but you can't see him. Yeah. And.
And so that's the wonderful use of the dog, and you shouldn't give up on those things. And, and so that's a good, I think, an important piece of that criteria for judging. So for those of you listening, I mean, we're recounting these stories of last year, but with the idea that hopefully you're getting an understanding of what this thing is about and why it's important.
And for the newer or people who maybe haven't done a trial there or any kind of trial before, the thing that really, the last thing that stood out to me was, I know John focused on positivity.
Yeah.
He mentioned that was I mentioned, I forgot to take the safety off. The first bird just flew. Cheese went on a big chase. He bumped one more bird while he was doing that and just kind of, I didn't stand there and scream at him.
Yeah, you didn't fuss at him.
I stood there and hit the whistle every 30 seconds or so and just he's a young dog, let him run it out. He came back and got at my side and we got our breath. I got him some water and we continued the hunt and put up the second bird and everything was fine. But that's something he mentioned after the fact he didn't mention directly to me. I don't think he was talking to somebody else. And I heard him say one of the biggest criteria for me is would I want to go hunting with you and your dog?
That was for me.
Having seen how you do this, would I want to go? Cause that's something, on the same, we're talking about with the guides that there's a way to have that conversation around gun safety without being overly negative and condescending.
Yeah, exactly.
It can be really crappy to hunt with somebody who's not good to their dog.
Who spends
the whole time yelling at their dog. I've been guilty of it.
Sure.
We all have been at some point because sometimes they just piss you off. Well, aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing.
It's like golf, right? Yeah. Or fishing. And I'm not a golfer at all. No. And there's a good reason for it. But it's whatever you happen to be doing, you get in the mode, you get in the zone, and it's easy to get frustrated. It's easy to kind of allow yourself to lose control of your emotions sometimes. But at the end of the day, one thing I love about this is it's keep it in the forefront of your mind. You're here to have fun. You're here to have a good time. And we should all remember that when we're out with our buddies hunting, and I mean, it is, we beat this thing to death, whether you're talking about my podcast or somebody else's, but there's that point in a sportsman's life where you get over the killing, you get over the numbers.
Yeah.
And it
that progression, that, like you're into methodology, you're into, you know.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what we want to do is promote getting to that place where you enjoy, you're there to enjoy the moment.
Let's do this because it's fun.
Exactly, man. And, you know, and it's a short life, and it's those stolen moments where we get to be in the field and feel good about ourselves and enjoy our dog and enjoy our company. And that's, again, you know, that to me is the goal of this entire thing we're doing.
Playing games with your dog.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, for those that have any interest whatsoever, again, if you've got a dog out there that you think, you know, you can enter in the hunting class, all they got to do is go find you a bird, handle it well enough for you to make an attempt at the game and hopefully get it back to you. But
that's one of my favorite things in your rules where it's all about, like, can you effectively put game in the bag,
especially
in that hunter's division. It's not about how, you know, style will win you some points. Sure. But ultimately, like, are we effective here?
Yeah. Are you effective and are you safe?
Yeah.
Right. And so that's the key. And so if you go out and you hunt with your dog and you have a good time, it doesn't matter. I don't care if it's the most broke dog on the planet. I don't even care if the thing makes a retrieve. Are you having fun? Mm-hmm. Right. You can pass without retrieve points. You can, in theory, it's going to be tough, but you can in theory pass without cutting a feather on a bird.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but the real thing is, are you out there enjoying your dog's company? Is the dog responding to you to some degree? Are you keeping your cool? Are you efficiently moving through the field? And if you are, you're doing a good job of hunting, and there's nothing wrong with that. And we should promote that, you know. So whether, I mean, I'm not a good shot. Yeah, and I don't want people to just fail because they can't shoot, you know,
right?
Or they're taking safety too seriously. I mean, I call safe all the time. I tell, when I judge, you know, open stake gun dog or open stake or gun dog stake field trials in the UKC, we have gunners in the field on liberated birds, and I always tell my gunners, like, you know, I don't want you taking a shot unless it's a perfect shot.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want this dog to fail because it wasn't able to make an epic retrieve, or to not win because it wasn't able to make an epic retrieve. Mm-hmm. Let the bird give you a layup, and when you got that perfect, clean, super safe shot, that's the one you take.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I got a blank gun in my back pocket, and I can pull that thing out and get the dog under judgment for hearing a shot and judge it through the shot. You know, and I think the same thing out there like that. So I always err probably way too on the side of caution when it comes to safety and shot placements out there in those crowded fields and stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't want anybody to get dinged for that. So you shouldn't feel as if you're, you know, it's super important that you put that bird down.
Right. But man, it feels good.
It does. Yeah. And so when it presents,
it feels better than missing.
Yeah. When you do it long enough, the you get the opportunity. The opportunities will come if you hang in there.
Well, you're talking about layups. That's the thing I think that probably improved my shooting more than anything is learning to recognize the layup.
Oh my God.
Just lay off when it's not, you can't do that.
Dude, I think of
shot
the first.
Physics, it doesn't work like that.
My first 15 to 20 years of duck hunting.
Yeah.
We're just like stupid shots, you know, and like once
shooting at 55 yards.
Yeah, yeah. And even just once you start shooting birds backpedaling into the decoys, like once you see it done right, then it just, you don't mind waiting on it.
It's bait fishing versus artificials.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean? It's the same thing. It's like I can go float, you know, minnow under a cork and catch pretty much any freshwater species in any river, stream, lake.
Yeah,
all over the Southeast. But man, something about like a clear moving water stream, whether it's a bass or a trout or whatever, and watching the eat happen.
Yeah.
That's, again, we're back to like the methodology. It's not good enough just to complete the task.
Yeah.
Like past a certain point, you want to control other variables in that process. And, like,
and I still enjoy a good like wood duck pass shoot or a dove shooting, but I know what I'm going to do. But if I'm hunting over a spread, I'm not taking bad shots anymore.
Right.
Like it's not fun to me. It's like the way it used to be, you know?
Yeah.
And so, and hopefully we can all move more in that direction with age and maturity and with time.
Yeah.
I expect all the kids out there to be still stacking them and having
they
fun.
They got to, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I don't have any problem with it, as long as they're being safe.
We talked about it earlier with like the younger hunters. You know, somebody took the time to explain this to me. I also think, you know, it's funny. You see it a lot in waterfowl hunting that like the younger set is complained about with like, I'm like, y'all, if we had like barrel stickers and TikTok and LED light bars and all that crap, when, you know, in 2002 when we were learning to duck hunt, and, you know, that we would have been doing it too.
Oh, for sure.
If shot cams existed back then, we'd have had shot cams and we'd have put it on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah. I don't hold any of the stuff against them. I mean, I think it's fun. I enjoy, especially when it's like those kids in that like 16 to 22, 23-year-old range where they're really just getting ate up with it and they start becoming somewhat proficient and competent.
We need those people. I mean, it's, you know, sure. We need people interested in it. What does they say? Duck stint numbers are declining every year.
Oh, it's just
fewer and fewer are sold.
Yeah, and it's sad. And at least there's a cool factor to duck hunting now. I think when you get into the upland space, the aesthetic appeals to it appealed to me as a young guy.
Yeah,
but at the same time, like you got to be a bit of a romantic from the get go to get into that, and especially when you're living in a state like this where we have opportunities are so limited. You know,
can even like with the right conditions on a duck, especially a goose hunt, you can produce. You know, you could be in it for the meat. Like,
yeah,
that's not the case in the upland game.
No.
We're not in it.
It's all sport. Uh-huh. It's 100% sport, and. I mean, you know, and there's benefits to it that are beyond the sporting aspect, you know,
right.
but at the end of the day, yeah, you're out there for your mental health and your physical health and to share that time with your dog. And so I'm excited for this February 3rd and 4th of 2024. We're going to be at H. Cooper Black. We've got the Triler flushing class. We have the Hunter flushing class. We have the Triler pointing class. And we have the Hunter pointing class, and there's going to be 2 days of that.
Yeah, so limited we got a spot for everybody.
Yep. So, and I don't expect us to fill all those entries. Right. That's a pile of dogs, but I would love for us to get enough entries for us to make it a viable opportunity for us to do it again next year.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to keep this thing going. And for those that came last year, we had a good time. This year should be that times two or three.
Yep.
You know, I think, you know, now that we've got these beautiful grounds, we've got this opportunity to have this banquet and, you know, share in each other's company and in between on Saturday night without ever leaving. Yeah, I'm super pumped, man. I'm so excited. So anybody that's got questions regarding, I guess we could dig into that a little bit. So,
yeah,
you know, I've talked on Nick's podcast about some of this, but at the end of the day, if you're a Triler class flushing dog, you know, I don't want it to be run exactly like a spaniel trial.
Yeah.
John is a spaniel judge. He's going to judge again this year. And when you're running under John, it's going to feel like a spaniel trial, spaniel hunt test, because he's got that objective lens on.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's still judged on being a hunt. But what we're looking for is basically your steadiness requirements. When you make contact with that bird, are you sitting to flush? Are you steady through the shot and through the fall if you need to be, and retrieving on command? And is that going clean? So if you're a spaniel trialer, or you've done HRC upland stuff with your lab and you've done a serviceable job with that, you got a grand champion, I think this will be a fun place for a grand dog to come out and show off.
Yeah.
You know, because they take the upland component pretty seriously there.
Okay.
For those guys, or if you're a guide, you know, or whatever else, and you got nice cockers and you want to show them off and you've got them broke, then, you know, bring them out and run that Triler class. That's probably going to be the hardest class to fill. We just,
oh yeah, for sure.
Not a ton of broke flushing dogs.
No, yeah,
especially in the Southeast.
I'm hunter class flusher all the way.
Yeah,
we are 0-for-3 on steady shot wing or flush wing and shot,
which is fine, and that's why the hunter class exists. So it's like, do you have a Boykin? Do you have a Springer or a Cocker? Do you have a lab that you go out and you kick up woodcock with, or you use to flush for your pointing dogs when you're guiding? Things like that. Bring those dogs out too and just kick them around the field and go hunt with them.
Lab won it last year.
Yeah. Yeah. My lab won it last year. Just unfortunately not under my hand.
Yeah.
So hopefully this year. So I'm still promoting this thing. I'm running this thing as hard as I can, but I've taken a step back in regards to like the executive functions because I just want to run in it. So I'm going to run in it this
Althea
year.
Althea whoops everybody this year. You're not winning your tournament.
Here's the thing about Althea, man. Like Althea can get mechanically as correct as anybody. She's steady. She's clean. She is not a great hunter. Like she's a very good flushing dog for the bird dog.
Yeah.
But she's like, her favorite place in the world to be is at heel. Mm-hmm. And if she thinks there's a bird in the opportunity, like in that bush over there, she'll go hunt it. And I can send her out for a while and get it going pretty clean. But if she's hunted 10 or 15 minutes without a contact, she's going to stop believing me and start, you know. So there's, Althea can easily be beat with clean work with a more intrepid dog.
That makes sense.
You know, and it's just not her name. But I don't, you know, I know the dog I got and I love her. I wish she was a little more intrepid, but at the end of the day, she wouldn't be the dog she is if she was.
Right.
So, you know, so she's the perfect dog for me, but, and clean. And then of course she had a son that won it or that won runner up last year. And same kind of deal. This guy comes out. Comes out and trains with me a lot. And that's Josh Garrison. We're hoping he comes back out again this year. Cause I love that dog so much. Yeah. Super, awesome dog named Cooper. But
that's right.
Yeah. But the more folks that come out with whatever else, like Althea and Cooper did really well because there wasn't a ton of competition.
Yeah. I think Graham had a Cochran Copper.
Yeah. Copper. Me. And we didn't break it into
trial. It was like three or four labs outside of that. Yeah.
And we didn't break it into trialer and hunters class last year. And that's so right. this is going to be a lot. There's a lot more opportunity for the hunters class guys this year. Cause those dogs have had a lot of practice sitting to the flush. And if you've hunted flushing dogs, you know, like it's just from a marking perspective and things like that. If you can get that dog to just stop for a second, mark his bird, then number one, you're getting, you know, you're not having to worry about delayed chase. You get the dog, it's already under control before it starts.
Right.
If there's a mark to be had, especially an easy one, they make it look so clean back and forth. It's hard to look at that kind of work and not appreciate it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but at the end of the day, do you need that to put birds on the ground and in the bag? Not at all.
No, you know? But man, what you're describing the first time I ever saw Cocker's run, I had my lab ham, and I knew that was 2 years before I ever got cheese, but I knew right then and there, like, I'm going to have one of those dogs.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Like, I just fell in love with it. I was like, got to have it.
They're so cool. Yeah. And maybe one day I'll have one again. I've had a few and, you know, right
it's
now.
It's been an adjustment. What you just described with Althea, like her favorite place is that heel. That's not like I've had to adjust to that, like from coming from a lab, you know, with Ham, I wanted him to stay close and he was within 10 feet.
Yeah.
And so that's what I got used to. And I feel like I have this instinct to get upset with Cheese when he's like wandering at, you know, 30 yards.
Sure.
And for him, that is staying close.
Yeah.
He's like, I am. I'm like, dude, stay close. And he kind of looks at me like, I am.
Yeah. What do you want from me?
I could be a mile away right now. You know how fast I am? Like,
and that's my bird dog. I say this all the time. I got Ella sitting in here behind us and she's, you know, she's one of my favorite dogs I've ever owned. She's a wonderful companion and house pet. But on the days like on a pretty day in the spring, when you go out and you fire up the grill and you got Althea out there, Althea is just going to be curled up asleep somewhere within like 10 feet of you at all times. And if you take your eyes off of Ella long enough,
she's
we got a farm that she's hunted her half her life behind us. And she's going to go out there and make
sure. I don't need you to go out there.
Yeah, she doesn't.
I know right where I'm going.
So she's happy to kind of, if she, especially if she knows you're not paying attention, she just assumes that's.
How do they know that? That's a spaniel thing. Like, my lab, Ham didn't do that. Like, Cheese is watching me constantly because the very second I get a phone in my hand and start messing with one of my daughters, like, he will be around the corner.
Yeah.
And he always comes back. He's not like running away, but he knows, like, oh, shit, he's not paying attention.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm. And Ella's the same way. I mean, I can turn her loose in the neighborhood, and she will go for 2 or 3 hours, and she will always end up on the back porch. Not saying I've ever done that on purpose.
Right.
It's happened. You know, but yeah, I mean, she's always coming home, and we're lucky we live far enough out in the country that it's not too big a consideration.
Yeah.
But at the same time, yeah, I mean, Althea just doesn't. She just doesn't want to go away. She just if you're not going there, she ain't going there. So, so there's that. So The flushing hunter and trialer class, the pointer trialing class, just think a dog steady to wing shot and fall, you know, and retrieving on command. Retrieve's going to play a role. And if your dog doesn't retrieve, you can still play. You're probably not going to win, but you can still pass.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something important to note. Your dog doesn't have to, it can blow complete categories and still pass.
Yeah.
You know,
they awarded the title of practical hunting dog.
That's right.
I love that. When I read that last year, like looking at signing up for the trial, I was like, man, that's a really cool way to look at that. That is probably what, because I was a staunch, like never going to trial.
Yeah.
When I started getting a bird dog, people were like, oh, yeah, they got spaniel trials. You should get into that. I'm like, man, that's not for me. I don't want
to
do that.
And I did it for, I really did it because I had so many clients that, they don't have any interest in field trialing, but they see what they're missing out on in terms of the community. I've got a handful of people that hang around the French Brittany trials that really aren't into the trialing at all.
Yeah.
But they love the community. And so they hang out there. And I just.
No, it was, that's a huge upside from doing it last year. It's like, I've met people who are into this that you can then like keep in touch with throughout the year, exchange info, just whatever. Like I love to bird hunt. I've been doing it. Like I said, went for the first time when I was 13, but I don't have a ton of friends that do it. Like majority of like my social group is a few of them will go with me like once a year, maybe.
A lot of them don't like to come back after you take them.
If the weather's good, like if it's a nice day, whatever. So it's nice to just have somebody to like yak at about this stuff. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Because people with the same affliction
at parties and social situations, folks will ask me about like, oh, you bird hunt or you duck hunt.
Yeah,
I've gotten to a point where I will look at them and be like, I'm giving you fair warning.
If you want to have this
right now, like, are you really curious and you want to know things? Because I could sit here and talk about this for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Or if that's just like a pleasantry question, I can answer with man, it's been a good season so far. Like, how about you? What you been up to? And we can go that way too. I just let me know. If you really want to know, I'll tell you, but I'm giving you
what's your level of interest? Because we can take this so far off the deep end.
Yeah.
Talking
about Earl Butts.
Yeah, exactly. I love that kind of stuff too, though, right, man. And I'm lucky, like I'm 43 and I've just now like started to develop like a core group of hunting buddies that I've never had. And I mean, we're still only getting out with each other a couple of times a season or whatever, but they're people that I know I can take them and drag them through the swamp looking for woodcock.
Yeah.
And they're going to want to go again next time.
If you're like me, you probably cycled a few through
it. I've burnt some people out. I've taken a few people on some like hikes. I
have declined to invite certain folks back. And I'm sure that there have been folks before that have declined to invite me back.
Oh, sure.
You don't always jive.
Yeah. Even when you're two, avid hunters, you have to, there's got to be certain things. Like, you go with some of those guys that are just killers. And it's just, to me, it's,
Oh, there's one place that's like, it's in a large, expansive county in eastern North Carolina, and I'm going to like leave names out to protect the innocent here. I got invited to this club one time. It was about my third trip down there.
Yeah.
It was like a loose kind of, it's not necessarily familial, but it is a family friend kind of relationship. And anyway, I get invited down there, and the like head dude at this place, in the dark, it's like 4 a.m. before we're going to the blinds. And I've got my dad's lab at this point. Samson was like at heel. He's on slip lead.
Yeah.
Like a 3-foot-long slip lead, not making a peep. And he's right beside me. I've got my gun case, my pack, waiters. Like I'm dressed, waiting by the truck, following all the rules, ready to go. And the dude just walks up to me out of nowhere. That dog's not going to F up my hunt, is he? He's not going to. That dog F's up my hunt, I'm going to shoot him.
Yeah,
and I looked right at him, and I was in my 20s, and this guy's in his like mid-50s and a lot bigger than me. And I just, Mr. So-and-so, if you shoot my dog, we are going to have a giant effing problem.
Yeah.
And I continued that day's hunt. Everything was fine. The dog did great.
Yeah.
He killed it. I've got a picture of him. I'll show you from that day. He ended up picking up birds for like the blind neck to us. He was great. Never got invited back after that. That was the last trip.
Sure, fair enough. Yeah. I mean, you advocated for your dog, and
I just kind of felt like if he was running around whining, like picking up decoys, causing problems, pissing on somebody's bag, like call me out. But I'm standing here.
A lot of times,
I'm the first one ready. I'm buttoned up, man.
Leave me alone. Yeah, and I mean, sometimes you get invited on those kind of things, and it's like there's the guy there that's going to be Johnny Big Bananas.
Yeah,
And when somebody doesn't recognize that, right? Like then he's not so inclined to invite you back. And those are the kind normally I'm not super excited to go back to those kinds of places, even if the shoot is good.
Oh, it was an incredible shoot.
Yeah. But
entails like hummingbirds on corn stalks.
Yeah. Maybe you want to go back to the property, but without the dude, And so
just know I'm not taking my dog this time.
But that's it. And so that's, again. Not to just keep bringing it back, but if you're listening to this stuff and it all sounds familiar
not that
to you,
kind of environment that we just described,
there's not a, ain't no Johnny Big Bananas at St. Hubert's trial. And
humility
there's
ability abounds.
Yeah, and well, we hope
to an extent,
as much. Sometimes
depends
I
on how late you hang around the campfire.
Exactly, that's exactly where my head was going with it. Don't let me win and get a few beers in me afterward. You're fine, so if anybody that does have questions about that, we're going to put some show notes up. We'll put Will's contact information. Yep. Will is the man. So Will's, he really has, we've been lucky that he's buttoned up. He's the kind of, you guys have heard me say this about myself. He's kind of the antithesis of the way I handle these things. So you can expect some communication back from him. Of course, you can go to the BDS website. You can go through there and link up with Terry Ann. Terry Ann's very, very well organized and can give you all the information. But if those real-time conversations, reach out to Will. He'll get you some answers. And so, again, look for those show notes. Will, if you want to put some information out on on the podcast, you're welcome to, in terms of email addresses or whatever, we can just save it for the notes.
Let's put it up on the notes, because what I'm probably going to do instead of routing it to personal, not that I care, it's not a special account, and that's the reason why I'm not going to give it to you guys, because I think my Gmail inbox, let me look at it, is sitting at like 14,657.
Is that it? That's a rookie numbers. You got to bump those up.
Yeah, those are rookie numbers. So what we'll probably do is like just set up a dummy Gmail account, like will@St. Hubert Society.
Okay,
US
good idea.
Or something
wouldn't
like
hurt
that.
To have something like that put together anyway.
So yeah, give us about 24 hours. We'll get something like that set up, and you guys can get a hold of me. Yeah, and like we said, feel free to reach out for real-time conversations, questions. I will guarantee that you'll probably get more anecdote than you bargained for.
Well, for sure. That's the fun part.
Into a conversation
that's
with
the fun
me.
Part. Yeah. And, you know, last words on that thing. We do have one of the kind of patrons, or I don't know what you'd call them, just friends of the St. Hubert's Club group already, is a big farmer in Darlington County, which is right down the road from Cooper Black. And he's got a lot of connections in the area. We're already talking about pigs, how many pigs we might need to cook Saturday night, hopefully.
Oh, yeah.
that kind of chat.
You guys do it right down there. That was it. In that part of the 843, they actually do like whole hog with vinegar, white slaw. I mean, I'm from the eastern part of the North Carolina, so any of like our Piedmont Triad listeners or Grayson's Piedmont Triad listeners are probably looking at me. Yeah, white slaw, vinegar sauce.
Yep. That's nice. So I, you know, having grown up all over North Carolina but happening to live, like right now we're 12 and a half minutes from the barbecue center in Lexington, where we sit right now.
As the crow flies, we're probably pretty close.
Yeah, and I don't ever say this in mixed company, but I much prefer Eastern style barbecue.
Yeah.
You know, I
it's
like
good. Home. I think there's something to the dip, the sauce, like there's, you know, the sweetness.
I do. Count. I mean, I still go to barbecue restaurants in Lexington and enjoy the barbecue. I really do. But it's, you know, when my mouth waters really thinking about what I want, it's that whole hog.
It's all that extra collagen.
So good. So I think that's good for the final word on St. Hubert.
Yeah.
You know, and we've beat you guys to death with this stuff, but we really mean it. You know, if it's you, if it's a friend you know that might enjoy something like this, come out. It's a party. It's a bird dog party. We're going to have the trial, but that's secondary to the fun. So please reach out. Come join us. Hope to see you guys all there. All the proceeds are going to go benefit the Bird Dog Society.
Yeah, it's a great organization.
Yeah, and we're super, super excited for that. We've got some conservation partners that are working on getting there. Hopefully have a biologist out from Quail and Pheasants Forever.
Nice.
Yeah, and especially that area. Like, so speaking of farmers in that area, I spoke to one the other day, and he's been having fun with his French Brittany and finding quail all over the place down there.
Nice.
So there's wild birds. They're making
that's
it.
That's good to
hear. Yeah, you know, and so enjoy. If you've never been in that part of the country either, you might think it's a place you might drive through if you're not a hunter and think there's not a whole lot going on.
Yeah.
But if you've ever hunted a bird, whether it be especially a woodcock or a quail, just driving through that kind of mid-state to low country of South Carolina, that heading from Darlington County to Florence area.
And the PD, man.
Oh my God, the PD River Basin, so beautiful. Yeah. And so kind of speak, that's our South Carolina cousins.
Yeah, same water.
Exactly, but there is a son of North Carolina.
That's a hell of a segue. Lima.
That was a famous sportsman here, and Will has been working on a new project, and I'm going to just kind of let you take over from here.
For sure. So this is a guy that's kind of, one of the first times I read about him, I saw him, or I read that he was compared to, or, you know, called North Carolina's Hemingway. So the old man and the boy, Robert Ruark, I'm sure some of you probably already figured that out, but he wrote that Old Man and the Boy series for Field and Stream. He's got at least four or five other best-selling novels to his name that I cannot call out right now. But this is kind of a challenge that we are naming after him because he is from North Carolina. And, you know, much like what Grayson's doing with the St. Hubert's trial, bringing something European over here to the States and doing it for the first time ever, I would kind of like to do that with what we're calling the Ruark Challenge. And it's not... This will be officially rolled out in 2024. So everything I'm about to tell you, you will have a chance to sign up, declare your intent, and be eligible for the challenge starting in like September of 2024. But effectively, this is all based on a novel. It's a Scottish novel from the 1920s called John McNabb. And over there, the Field magazine puts on something which is kind of like, what would that compare to? Is that like Project Upland is for us over here? Maybe a little more like Covey Rise?
Well, the field is, I'd say the field, yeah. I mean, so in terms of prestige,
yeah.
You know, we have these new modern kind of print deals like Project Upland, Covey Rise. Mm-hmm. I would say Garden and Gun, maybe more.
A little more lifestyle?
Yeah, it's got, I mean, the shooting lifestyle.
Right.
In England and in all of Great Britain.
It's a whole thing.
In the UK. Yeah. I mean, it kind of wraps into, it's a little more buttoned up. It's buttoned up,
yeah.
And it's got its own real culture around it.
Right.
You know, and for us, we do too, you know, but at the same time, you know, I would say that this magazine would be more akin to like what Field and Stream would have been when it was Forest and Stream. You know,
it's got
a super long history, and it's the publication. If you're into sporting pursuits in the UK, you're taking the field.
You're familiar with it.
Yeah.
So yeah, anyway, they run this challenge that's based on the Scottish novel, and the challenge is born out of this sort of passage in the novel where there are on, let's say, just a cold, rainy night, not much going on. There's three dudes. Characters in the novel, they're sitting in a pub, and they're much like what we just talked about, you know, don't look for humility around the campfire the night after the, you know, Saturday of the St. Hubert's. These guys are kind of, they're bragging, they're talking to each other, and the gauntlet gets thrown down that basically one dude says to another, hey, this is how good I am in terms of being a sportsman. I can sneak onto your property, and in a 24-hour span, I will take a brown trout on the fly. It's a red stag, and it's a pair of grouse. They call it brace of grouse over there.
Yeah.
And I'll do all that. I'll leave the property. You will never know I was there. Like, I'm that good that I can sneak on, knock this out, and go. And so the field, I think this has been going on since, like, the 60s or 70s for them. They kind of – people started trying it and talking about it, and they sort of put forth this challenge that obviously the – poaching angle there is in good jest. You know, we're doing this these days with a landowner who is
giving us permission.
Yeah, given permission and excited for you to be out there trying to complete this feat of conservation. So the American version, the North Carolina version that we're going to start with, are acceptable Rourke combos. And this has to happen in a 24-hour period of dusk to dawn. It must be witnessed. So there's got to be a witness that can attest is with you to like, yes, I saw it all happened. So here are our combos. The early season is going to be a pair of doves, and that must be harvested in a single volley that applies only to the early season. Because my thought there is it's not too hard to go out and kill two doves.
No.
But I did them in a single volley.
I shot my double this year.
I knocked a double out as well. Yeah. So felt good about that. It's going to be an archery whitetail buck because early season you'll be in September, and it's going to be a black bass species on the fly. So that can be spotted. Rock bass, that can be largemouth bass, that can be smallmouth bass. Wherever you are in the state, you should be able to find one.
And I'm not a biologist, and the first time we discussed this, you said black bass, and honestly, it didn't register.
That's the family, yeah. And really, I shouldn't say rock bass. I just misspoke because I learned that over the summer that rock bass it's a misnomer. Those are a sunfish.
Really?
So then there were like red mouse, sunfish, red eye bass, Roanoke bass. They're not bass, yeah.
No kidding.
They're sunfish. That's why they're so aggressive.
Huh.
Anyway, so kind of getting back to it, the black bass family. So somewhere in, you know, the state of North or South Carolina, you can find one not too far.
Largemouth is pretty much available in every county.
Got to be in moving water.
Okay.
No farm ponds.
Okay.
So that's the other thing. Like, this is a sporting challenge here.
Gotcha.
We can have it can be a lake, but it must be publicly accessible water.
Okay.
So it can't be like your granddad's farm pond that you know, has
12, I mean, I can go out and catch two largemouths in the back pond right now.
We want you going to the local creek. We want you going to the local wildlife
access. Yeah. I know where I'm going. Yeah, I already got it in my head.
I know you do. and so that's your early season. A classic Rourke is going to be a pair of wood ducks, limit one hen, whitetail buck. That can be rifle, shotgun, archery, whatever's in season, black bass on the fly. And then in honor of, you know, Grayson's kind of, I guess you'd call it mentorship, like encouragement to, hey, put this out there. We're going to do the Lost Highway Rourke, and that's going to be a pair of woodcock.
Oh, nice.
A whitetail buck and a black bass on the fly. So those are, you know, the kind of three combos that you can put forth. Obviously, you know, quick rules, everything is to be undertaken in a legal, sporting, and gentlemanly fashion. You got to complete them within one day between September 2nd, 24 and January 1st, 2025, because that's the last day of deer season. So once deer season's out, you
know, it doesn't make sense. Yeah.
And that's, you have to be really in tune with the regs, because
yeah,
there's only certain periods of the year where you could even
get the overlap of everything.
Get the overlap and go pull one off, right? Yeah. And especially depending on if you're like Northwest Zone or Central or Eastern, where you are is going to dictate like what kind of Rurik you can pull.
It'll
off
be fun moving forward, seeing that, kind of seeing what the regional variances are.
Yeah. We're going to take 12 prizes to be awarded, would be the max in any given year. So okay. We'll take as many entries as we want, but we're capping it at 12. Once the 12th is completed for that period, we're shutting it down and you can try again next year.
Okay.
To just kind of keep it kind of exclusive.
Yeah.
Everything is undertaken at the competitor's expense. You got to do it in a legal and sporting manner from a landowner who accepts the challenge.
Sure.
The Rurik Society's decision as to the validity of any entry is final.
Okay.
So that's going to be, you know, you submit your day. Here's what happened. You know, I got up and went on a duck hunt. Here's my two ducks. Then, you know, hit the river and we caught the bass and we spent the afternoon in the blind or on a stalk or what have you. You know, if you're in a county where running dogs is legal.
Yeah.
I might go deer over hounds, you know.
Oh, that's a
gun your deer over hounds like that.
I feel like late season in Anson County might be where I'm going.
Be pretty cool somewhere in like lower Moore County or northern Moore County, right? Or is it southern?
I can't remember where they got the dog. I mean, the dog.
I think it's below 24-27.
And I was about to say, once you get me below 24-27, I just get disoriented. Uh-huh. Like I've even lived in that area, but for whatever reason, it just doesn't come together.
So that's something we're going to do. And basically the way we're going to set this up is there's going to be an entry fee. It's going to be $200 to get yourself in, to get your name in, and like 50 of that is going to be kept by the Rurik Society to put on the champions dinner, to do all that fun stuff for my entries. The majority of that money is going to be paid right out to one of three conservation orgs of your choice. We'll have some options when we get this up and running,
so you'll
be able to pick somebody like Woodcock Society, like Ducks, like QDMA, like, you know, Audubon, whatever, what have you, wherever you want to put it.
Yeah. I need to call Hank Forrester on this. He's friends, good friends with the landowner here.
Yeah.
And he's the QDMA, you know, he's just a big player in QDMA, but does a lot of the field to fork stuff for them. I think he would enjoy.
Yeah.
You know, he's a North Carolina boy.
Well, because, you know, when I read about this, I thought it was so cool, and the way that the field presents this, the way they brand this thing, is that this is the ultimate argument for conservation, right? The fact that there exist properties where you can do all of this in one day.
Sure.
You can knock it out in one, and in a time of year when a day is not very long, dawn to dusk period is around, what, 11 hours right now?
Yeah.
You know, we got less than 12 hours of light, and this would be one of your windows to go get it done. So just imagine like the pulling off that feat and really doing it in a legal and sporting manner above board. You got your witness and then you're in the society. And so the prize is going to be a pewter tankard so we can all share a drink together at the end of the period and, you know, toast to the sporting pursuits of those who are successful in their quest for a Rurik. But you get the tankard once, your invite to that dinner extends into perpetuity.
Oh, that's great.
So my hope is that, you know, in 5, 10, 15 years, we've got a thing going where there's, you know, 100 people coming out to a big banquet to all talk about conservation in the Carolinas.
Yeah, I think
we've all like achieved this feat. We've performed this task.
Played a real role. Like, I mean, from a sporting perspective, I mean, I think we all do, but it's such a personal pursuit to most of us that even if we've got duck hunting buddies or whatever, I've always struggled with this. And DU is a fantastic organization, Delta, all these other groups, but I'm usually when I'm at those places, I'm not with my hunting buddies.
No.
Do you know what I mean? And so it'd be really cool to just kind of, again, just an opportunity to build community amongst people that are
imagine 100 people dropping $200-$300 every year to enter this thing and the kind of impact we could be having on an organization that does work in North Carolina, the kind of money we could be putting forth to fund game land purchases.
I love it.
To create public accesses on rivers and streams. You know, that's kind of the thing. I'm really lucky in that I have a place that's been in my family where I can go and hunt private land.
Sure. But
at the end of the day, you know, what we have access to is around 300 acres.
Yeah.
Which is great. It's big. It's bigger
than what most people have. It's a lot if there's just a couple of people sharing it. Yeah.
But, you know, how many times can you make that loop with a bird dog before you've made that loop, right? So it's just what you were talking about with Ella. So like you want to hunt new places. So public land has, even though I do have access to private land, like that public land access is a huge part of my hunting journey.
We forget how lucky we are to be in a state that does have, you know, it's not the best public land state in the country, But
it could be worse.
It could be a lot worse. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's when you really get out and explore it, when you really do it, I'm always surprised by how much access I do have and right. how much wonderful, you know.
How close it is to you. Yeah. I mean, living here, I'm in Winston. You're right down south of town. I mean,
there's
a lot right around us that I never would have known about if I hadn't just started looking and started
Absolutely.
Digging.
Yeah. And I spend so much of my, you know, starting October, you know, for me, through February,
burning boot leather.
Yeah, just loving it. I mean, still, that's my favorite thing in the world to do is just be out there in our local public land and remember, you know, it just ties you to home a little better. So, and this is another thing, this is a great opportunity for that. So if anybody's out there listening that has, you know, has any interest in that, obviously it's in the earliest stages. This first public announcement.
Yeah, if it sounds cool to you, get a hold of me. Like so here's the thing. Like, I use some of you, well, y'all don't know this because y'all don't, you're probably not many of you listen to the podcast I used to do for the organization that shall not be named, but I talked a lot on there about my past experience as a food truck owner. And I actually do still have an account out there for that food truck with about 2,000 followers that I need to do something with. So that's going to get transitioned into a place for like this content to be done for me to talk about things like the Ruark and you know, give you a place to go to access rules to, you know, see who I am and what I'm doing. But, you know, bear with me because I'm announcing it. None of that infrastructure exists yet, but between now and, you know, say I'll give it February because I'm not going to do much except for hunt and do the holidays with my family between now and like St. Hubert probably.
I think St. Hubert's, I mean, it falls right in line with this, you know, and so it's an opportunity for us to get together. If you're going to be at the St. Hubert's trial,
that's actually a really good point. I will have something, I'll have an online landing place for this before we get to the St. Hubert's
trial.
You're there, I can, hey, go check this out.
Yeah, and we'll probably have a little sidebar over there, I'm sure. So anybody that's interested and you're going to be at St. Hubert, come join us over there and let's start planning the 2024-2025 Ruark Challenge.
Because I've been close. Like, have you, this is the thing that I inventory, and I think I've got like 4 days where the opportunity was there.
Yeah.
And I was close.
So starting December 19th, starting December 11th. Sorry. For me, that's, that's a good poke for me. So like late season deer season for me is like when around the holidays, really around Christmas is when I'm a preferential evening sitter.
Oh yeah, 100%.
You know, and so it makes those kind of days where I can get up early in the morning, take a crack at some wood ducks,
knock out your birds.
Yep, or take a crack at some woodcock after that, and then go. Luckily, I live a quarter mile from Tom Alex.
Yep,
and we'll get on the canoe out there and see what we can get done for the bass, and
go find one.
Yeah, and make it happen. So I'm pumped. I'm going to try it for this year. I don't know whether or not we're having anything formal about it, but I'm going to actually try
You got to have one to enter into the record books to start it, at least an attempt.
Yeah.
I've made an unofficial attempt on November 11th.
Yeah.
Cheese, my cocker, was the first time ever. I sent you that picture. First time ever duck hunted him. He did.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. It was cool.
Well, the first bird, man, that was funny. Like, he didn't want to pick that thing up. It was crippled. It was kicking. He was just like, what is this? This is bigger than anything I've ever seen. I'm supposed to grab that.
Sure.
But he figured it out, and I actually caught a fish later that day, and I'm now like kind of looking at it. It was rainy, it was cold, it was windy, and I just sort of, you know, as embarrassing as it is to admit, college football was on, and the fire was warm, and the beer was cold, and I was like, yeah, maybe another day.
Yeah.
But I'm going back. I will probably be attempting one on December 11th as well. I'm going, actually, this Sunday, headed to the farm and going to hunt woodcock opener down there. So
awesome, man. Well, I'm pumped for this opportunity. I'm pumped for us to have, you know, it just gives us a reason to stay in touch with each other, to keep working forward, to get in the field with each other. And when I say each other, I don't just mean me and you. I mean,
the listeners.
Everybody out there, call your buddy, go out and try. You know, this is just a fun pursuit. Give it a shot.
And it gives you something for the winter. I always like when my family and friends start talking about how much they're not looking forward to the winter and how it's going to get dark and cold. I hate it. I'm sitting there like, how sad for you.
Yeah.
They're like, you don't have something to look forward to this time. And you're like, I do. Like, I'm more excited for this than I am anything. Oh, yeah. I mean, I just like.
And get your kids out there with you.
Yeah.
You know, share this with them. Because I feel so lucky that this is a part of my life. That this is, you know, it makes you appreciate, and this is so sappy, but that life's not just about the pursuit of wealth. And
there's
so, you know what I mean? And it's spending time in the woods. if you can't recognize how lucky we are, especially as Americans and all that, you know, just the normal general great gratitude stuff that you hear everywhere else.
The season for gratitude.
It is. It really truly is. So I think that's a the right note to wrap thing up on.
That's a perfect little bring it right down, put a pin in it.
So out there, guys, if you're listening, thanks again for listening. And don't forget to go visit www.uglydoghunting.com. That's my buddy Mike Nadusky. And Mike is Mike's the man in the retail dog game, sporting dog game. So he's the one and only sponsor of this podcast. Obviously, Lost Highway Gun Dogs as well. If you got questions about any of my services, you're welcome to reach out here. And Will, thank you for being here, buddy.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right.
Appreciate y'all listening to me ramble, and hopefully we'll run across each other again soon.
We'll do it, man. Thanks a lot.
Hey, listeners, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast. As fans of this show, you may be interested in the conversations on the Birdshot Podcast, where we discuss all things upland hunting, from upland birds and their habitat and conservation to the shotguns, bird dogs, and gear used to pursue them. Whether you're a seasoned upland hunter or just getting started and wanting to learn more, I interview a wide range of guests, each with their own unique perspective and valuable experience to share. If you're on the hunt for more upland hunting conversation, please consider subscribing to the Birdshot Podcast today. We'll